So we have the tax collectors and the sinners. The sinners were just a group name for people who were, well, they were the morally reprehensible of society. This is the scum. This is the group of complete lowlife. That's what we have on one hand. Then the other hand, complete opposite, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, the religious elites, the respectable people, the guardians of moral decency. Complete opposite. And this second group makes a complaint. They're grumbling about Jesus. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. It's a grumble about justice. It's a grumble about what's fair, about what is right. Now we hear, I don't know, maybe I hear, children often say, it's not fair. And they feel it very, very strongly. And as we grow up, that feeling, I think we still feel that need for justice. We want things to be fair. And if I might put it bluntly, sinners are not to be welcomed. I'll give you an illustration. Now imagine that you're in Costa, sitting at a table with your coffee, or if you prefer, you've gone into the pub, you just sat down at a table with your pint, and suddenly there is a hush over the whole room. Everybody goes quiet because somebody has walked in, and everyone's staring at this person. An old man has just walked into the room. You hear the name being kind of whispered around, but it is unmistakable. This is Adolf Hitler. 127 years old, he survived in hiding in Little Paxton, and he walks into the anchor, and everybody is hushed. Nobody knows what to do. Then someone on the table next to you gets up and rushes toward him, and you think you know what's coming, but this person embraces him, shakes his hand. It's lovely to meet you. Let me buy you a drink. Would you do me the honor of coming to join me at my table? There's a hand on the shoulder. Conversation flowing, laughter, joking, and you think there is something not right about that. Now, somebody who deserves to answer for their crimes, sinners, should not be welcomed. It's about justice, and we care about justice. Now, if we hear the news, particular things we hear in the news, particular crimes, terrorism, crimes against children. It's just in this last week we've heard a little bit more about Ian Brady, one of the Moors murderers. He died last week, responsible for the torture and the death of 5 children. Being reminded of his crimes shakes us. And we don't expect people like that to be welcomed, and we certainly don't expect them to be celebrated. We want justice. So this episode here tells us about tax collectors and sinners gathering around Jesus. They want to hear what he has to say, and Jesus welcomes them, and not just welcomes them, he eats with them. And in that society, to eat with someone was a declaration that you accept them. So the Pharisees complain. This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Jesus responds to that complaint, a complaint about justice. You can't pretend this is okay. It's not right. It's not right to accept people like that. So he responds, Jesus responds with a story, a parable. And this is a story which is about lostness. Jesus tells the story. Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Story about a sheep that gets lost. It's a very simple story, really. A very simple, but it's a very significant idea. Jesus, well, there may have been some shepherds listening to him, but principally he's talking to the religious elite. He's talking to people who knew the writings of their prophets. And one of their prophet songwriters, one of his lyrics is, "I have strayed like a lost sheep." Another of the prophets said this, "There's the sheep somewhere." There we go. Another one said, "We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to our own way." And when Jesus tells a story about a lost sheep, he's really talking about people. And he's connecting to this idea about people who go their own way, like a wandering sheep. A sheep who decides which way he wants to go, who decides which path to take, who refuses the guide of the shepherd and ends up lost. Talking about people who go their own way, who run life according to their own rules. Either they say, there is no God to tell me what to do, or they say, if there is a God, he has no right to tell me what to do. And they plow through life without any thought of God. Now Jesus calls this lostness. And we might not agree with him. And we might not call that lostness. It's how most people live today, isn't it? Now, a prophet of our time says, let it go. It's time to see what I can do to test the limits and break through. No right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free. Or maybe a little bit more in defiance. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. Or maybe another prophet more popularly. I did it my way. We celebrate these things, don't we? We don't call that lostness. But we might not call it lostness, and yet it seems to me that there is a feeling of lostness that haunts so much of our society. And this simple image of a lost sheep, I think that might well resonate with us today. A couple of our friends just returned from holiday south of Spain. We were talking to them. They read a lot of novels when they're away, and we're talking about what they liked, what they didn't like, and they said, we read one which was a Booker Prize winning novel. So of course that was depressing. Because it's only depressing books that win literary prizes. I don't know if you ever thought about why that might be the case. Last year in the New York Times Book Review, a couple of authors were asked about this. They were asked which subjects are underrepresented in contemporary fiction. What are story writers not writing about? And the answer is, without their answer, today writers are flummoxed by joy. Instead, they seem to have decided that despair, alienation and bleakness are the most meaningful and interesting descriptions of the human condition. See, the same with films. The more acclaimed a film is, the more bleak and hopeless it is. We see it with EastEnders. Desperately depressing week after week. Why do people put themselves through that? Why do you do it? Ray, it's all right. Why do you do it? Bleak and hopeless. Because the thing is, now, without hope, we are lost. Aren't we? Something about our human nature, we need to hope. I think about a couple of people, two people who are very, very similar, similar background, similar temperament, they're very, very similar people. They both get a new job, it's the same job. And their job is, they're told, you take this box, you put it on this one, and you move it along. Get this one, put it on this one, move it along. You do that repeatedly, all day long, that's your job. And they sit in the same room, same conditions, day after day, week after week. There's just one difference between these two people. And one of them is told, at the end of the year, you'll get paid £20,000. The second one is told, at the end of the year, you'll get paid £20 million. So after a couple of weeks, the first one is saying, this is driving me nuts. Now, aren't you thinking about quitting? And the second person says, no way. I whistle while I work. Two people who experience the same thing, but in very different ways. And the difference is what they expect from the future. We are hope-based creatures. Hope matters, and if we haven't got hope, then we're lost. And that means that when we go our own way, when we take God out of the picture, I wonder how we can hope. Or maybe if I could ask that more specifically, when we go our own way, we plot our own course, how do we deal with the rubbish in life? Now, what can we say about suffering? Now, we could, lots of people do, kind of say, well, we can find some kind of meaning. We can import a meaning into suffering. The thing is, though, if we do that, when we've gone our own way and God's removed from the picture, the purpose we find in suffering must be a purpose for the here and now. It's got to be a purpose for today. It can't be for the hereafter. And I think that's a very narrow frame of reference. And I think it can make a suggestion of purpose in suffering sound horribly hollow. A guy called Paul Vitt said this. He says, what does one tell a chronically overambitious man who learns at age 40 that further advancement is over and that he has a serious, possibly fatal illness? What does one say to the older worker who has lost his job, whose skills are not wanted? What does one tell the woman who is desperately alone inside an aging body with a history of failed relationships? Does one advise such people to become more autonomous and independent? Does one say, go actualize yourself in creative activity? For people in those circumstances, such advice is not just irrelevant, it is an insult. that we've plotted our own paths. We've chosen our own way to go. When God is removed from the picture, what can we say about suffering? We could rage against it. Might be something in that. Scream and shout, but to whom are we shouting? If we rage, we assume there's some kind of ideal that life has departed from, but where did that come from? A cry of rage might include a cry, a demand for justice. We feel that. We long for justice. We hear about awful things and we want the rights, we want the wrongs to be put right. We experience awful things. And we don't want to see people get away with evil. But if we demand justice, where do we go with it? Now, when God's taken out the picture, when we've gone our own way, how can we hope? Now, what do we say about suffering? We could ignore it. Maybe that's the status quo. We distract ourselves, avoid the question. But sooner or later, it's going to catch us up and bite us on the backside. Hope matters, and without hope, we are lost. And maybe the greatest problem is to find a hope that can make sense of death. Now, we live in a time of intense lostness, and I say that because as far as I can see, people don't know what to do with the most inevitable fact of our existence. The fact that we are terminal. Our days are numbered. Whether our days are many or few, whether they're filled with joy or sorrow, they come to an end. Now, of course, people try to deal with it. People have to. But the attempts are just not satisfying. Now, people say we just must accept it as natural. Happens to us all. We just go with it. Now, maybe that works. I'm just not sure death feels very natural. And many people are terrified of it. Now, the poet Dylan Thomas, I think writing about his father, wrote, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." I think that feels like a more appropriate response. The founder of modern psychology, Carl Jung, said this. He said, "Death is indeed a fearful piece of brutality. There is no sense of pretending otherwise. It is brutal not only as a physical event, but far more so psychically. A human being is torn away from us, and what remains is the icy stillness of death. There no longer exists any hope of a relationship, for all the bridges have been smashed at one blow." That lost sheep, think about it. It's gone its own way. But as it's gone its own way, it means that it is wandering alone and it is cut off from relationship. In fact, the word lost means destroyed, perishing. The awfulness of being lost is the terminal nature of relationships. And so Jesus tells this story. He tells a story about a lost sheep, a story that illustrates those who go their own way, those who remove God from the picture of life. A lost sheep that I think resonates with the uncertainty and the hopelessness and that lingers in the background of our lives today. A hopelessness that has got to come to the surface if we dare to think about death. Of course, though, the story about the lost sheep is really a story about finding. Jesus says, "Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it?" Story about a shepherd who is totally committed to finding. The shepherd would be anxious. His sheep is missing. Where has it gone? What will have happened to it? Will it have fallen and hurt itself? Will he find it before the wild animals do? And so the shepherd searches until he finds it. And the shepherd goes as far as it takes to find the lost sheep. It's a question, actually, isn't it? Did you notice that? Jesus is asking a question. One of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep? Does he? No, would he really do that? Would a shepherd really leave 99 in the open country to go after the one that was lost? Or wouldn't they just cut their losses? No, look after the 99. This isn't a story about being a prudent farmer. It's a story about a shepherd who is passionately committed to go as far as it takes to find the lost. And Jesus tells a story about himself. A little bit later on, he says, "I have come to seek and to save what was lost." And Jesus tells this story as he journeys towards Jerusalem. Now, he knows that when he gets there, he will die. He will be killed. And yet he's resolute. He is committed, determined to get to Jerusalem. And this story explains why. Jesus is totally committed to find the lost. He will go as far as it takes. So he left the glory of heaven, he came down, he lived as a man, and he went to the cross and he died a cruel death, because that's how far he had to go to find his lost sheep. Now, it's in the death of Jesus that the questions about justice begin to be answered. Now, we care about justice. All of us care about justice. But God cares about it much more than we do. And so how can Jesus welcome sinners? Well, the answer is, he is prepared to go as far as it takes to find the lost. Now, that prophet of old who wrote, "We all like sheep have gone astray, each of us has turned to our own way," he continues and says, "And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." Now, we care about justice. But the uncomfortable reality is that if justice is to be done, then we all might find that our wandering from God, our rejection of him, that too needs to be accounted for. And so the prophet wrote about Jesus. Specifically, he wrote about Jesus' death on the cross. Because that's how far Jesus went. God cares about justice. And he's the only one with the right and the power to bring everyone to account. But Jesus can welcome sinners. He can do that because he was prepared to stand in their place. He was prepared to be dealt with as they deserve. The punishment that was due to sinners was taken by Jesus. That's how far he was prepared to go so that he could find and welcome sinners. Now, the death of Jesus answers the complaint about justice. But it also answers the problem of lostness. Now, this story about the shepherd, he goes after the lost sheep until he finds it, and when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulder and goes home. Then he calls his friends and neighbours together and says, "Rejoice with me, for I have found my lost sheep." It's a picture of what Jesus would do for us. The 19th century preacher Charles Spurgeon said, "It's a soul-melting thought that Jesus, the Son of God, would lift the lost to his own shoulder. He doesn't drag, he doesn't shove. He's not cross, he's not frustrated after the long search. He does it with joy. And then when he gets home, and did you notice that he goes home? He takes the found sheep home. He doesn't take the found sheep back to the open country. He takes the found sheep home. And he invites others to join him so the celebrations can go on. Because there is a deep delight in finding lost sheep. That lost sheep out on its own was cut off, severed from relationships, but the found sheep is held near, brought home. Others are gathered to celebrate. And the end of the story is a picture of heaven. That's what Jesus tells us. He says he sees heaven as a place of joy-filled relationships. Now, the Christian hope gives a very solid answer to the lost hopelessness of a world that doesn't know how to deal with death. Now, the Christian hope isn't a hope of escape. It's not a hope of halos and clouds. It's a hope of relationship. See, heaven is the home of God. God who is in himself utterly relational, in his own nature, one God in three persons, the Father and the Son and the Spirit. And eternally between these persons, there's an infinite and a perfect and a raging and a powerful love. They have been pouring love into one another in inexpressible joy since before time began, and they'll do so into eternity. That's why the Bible says God is love. Now, he is the original love. He is the source of all the love we've ever known. And however much love we might have found on earth in our relationships, however much love we might have experienced, The 18th century theologian Jonathan Edwards said that our relationships are clogged. They're like a water pipe that's filled with sand and dirt. Just a trickle of water can get through. But in heaven, the pipe is unclogged. In heaven, love flows freely. Love is always perfectly reciprocated. Love is never suppressed. It's never stuttering. Love is never crippled by envy or selfishness. And wonderfully, love is never disrupted or halted by separation. Heaven will bring us to share directly in the eternal love of God Himself. Now, the Christian hope for heaven is not an escape from this earth, it's a hope for the transformation of this earth as heaven and earth come together. And the basis of the Christian hope is that 3 days after Jesus died, He was raised again to life. It's the resurrection of Jesus Christ that gives us a promise. It promises that there's a joy that all of our earthly sorrows can only ever enrich and deepen until they finally give way to it. Rising from the dead might sound fantastical. The historical evidence for it is formidable. Now, if you've never seriously considered the resurrection of Jesus Christ and asked yourself, did this happen? I would urge you to do so. Now, the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ answers the problem of lostness. Did you see what the sheep did to get home? Did you see what the sheep did? No, this hope isn't for the religious. It's not for those who think they're righteous. This gift is for the lost. It's for sinners who need to repent. It's for those who admit that they're not good enough and they need a saviour. It's for those who hold up their hands and say, I've been going my own way and I'm lost. And if I'm honest with myself, I am without hope and I need someone to find me. I need someone to lift me. I need someone to carry me home. You see, this story about lostness and finding is also a story that invites us in. Begins with these two groups of people: tax collectors and sinners, the lost, and then the Pharisees, those who stand aloof, those who think they don't need to be found, but actually are like the 99 who end up left in the open country. Now, these two groups of people invites us to ask which group we would want to associate with. Now, if you know something of this lostness, then know that there is one who delights to find the lost.